Growing up in Leicestershire in the 1950s, there isn't much to keep a young mind occupied. Children spend the long summer afternoons unsupervised, roaming over every inch of the towns, villages, and surrounding countryside, purely for something to do. So when schoolgirl Tina Negus comes to her teachers with tales of strange markings on the rocks near her favourite blackberry picking spot in Charnwood Forest, they shrug it off as little more than the imaginings of a bored adolescent. A year later, three more schoolchildren, Richard Allen, Richard Blatchford and Roger Mason, are scrambling over the same rocks when they too spot something curious inscribed in the stone. Despite the conviction of all three, their jaded teachers refuse to believe them, thinking it merely to be a ruse designed to lure them out into the woods and forego their lessons for a fun day out in the forest. The adults give the matter no more thought, but Roger Mason is not so easily deterred. With the support of his father, who never doubts anything young Roger says, he goes straight to the most senior geologist he can find. Despite his commitments as professor of geology at Leicester University, Trevor Ford is won over by Roger's earnest plea and concedes to scramble among the blackberries and over the sloping rocks to see what the boy has found. And as it turns out, none of the schoolchildren had been lying. Pushing aside brambles and leaf litter, Trevor runs his fingers over some of the most remarkable and puzzling structures he has ever seen. They look like leaves or gigantic feathers trodden into the rock by some titanic force. Each of their delicate veins is picked out in exquisite detail by the subtle rise and fall of the sandstone itself. At the time, Ford knew of no mechanism by which a leaf or feather could become so impressed in solid sandstone. Except at the moment of that rock's formation, leading him to the inescapable conclusion that this was a fossil remnant of some unknown organism or process. And yet even more remarkably, Ford knows that this area of Charnwood Forest is underlain by some of the most ancient rocks in England. They are Precambrian, long predating the appearance of leaf-bearing plants or feather-clad birds. In fact, these rocks long predate any known fossil visible with the naked eye. This specimen, staring defiantly back from the surface of the rock, is a paradox, a conundrum. In that moment, young Roger and the professor find themselves teetering on the edge of a precipice of discovery, much greater than the small bluff that they are standing on. This find is something stranger than anything the geological world has seen for 100 years. In time, Trevor Ford will extract the precious fossil from its Brackeny home. Huge slabs of rock weighing more than 200 kilograms are levered out and transported back to the university. The strange structure is confirmed as a fossil of a long-lost creature of immense Precambrian age. But this Charnia Masoni, so named for its modern-day home forest and the tenacious child that found it, is but the first of many such fossils to be ultimately recovered from rocks of that age. And together, they paint a picture of a stranger world than any paleontologist would dare to imagine. In the twilight of the Proterozoic, not long before the dawn of animals as we know them, the seafloor bristles with truly alien life. Where before there had been little more than a few branching algae and fungal filaments, for the very first time there are now living behemoths that cast their shadows across the shallows, looming eerily across the abyssal plains. Strange quilted pennants wave in the current. Bushy thickets of fleshy plumes tangle amongst themselves. And vast flattened sheets flap and tumble across the ocean bottom. This is a biological world unlike anything seen before or since, but the Precambrian rocks do not lie. For a brief period, these alien life forms really did rule our seas. What were they? Where did they come from? And what became of these first strange experiments of evolution as the sun rose on the Cambrian world? An entire decade before Roger Mason and his classmates fought to get their mysterious fossils the attention they deserved, a very similar event unfolded halfway around the world, and this time with adult geologists who really ought to have known better. In 1946, the Australian geologist Reginald Sprigg found himself in the barren wilds of the Flinders Range in South Australia. He'd been sent by his government to determine whether defunct silver and copper mines in the area could be made profitable once again. He worked alone. After all, it didn't take a big team to peer into the dark recesses of an overexploited mine and see that it was bare. And so, as he sat eating his lunch in the shade of a stunted sugar gum, listening to the lazy drawl of insects in the afternoon heat, he absent-mindedly turned over the plate-like slabs of rock around him. The layers had been baked free from their parent bedrock by the sheer heat of the sun. And now Reg peered with fascination at the strange markings to be seen on their newly aired undersides. Up to 10 centimeters across, they were broadly circular, concentric in places, sometimes endowed with radial ridges around their outer edges. To Reg, they looked just like the jellyfish he'd often seen stranded on the beaches of his South Australian hometown. To him, they were far too complex to have been made by inorganic geological processes. He was convinced that they were fossils, and named the group of strange circular forms after the Aboriginal name for the sheep station closest to his lunch spot. Ediacara. And yet Reg Sprigg faced a conundrum. He knew enough about the local geology and the nature of the fossil record in these parts to be thoroughly confused. The rocks of the Flinders Ranges were supposed to be Precambrian in age, but fossils of this size and complexity were known only from rocks that were Cambrian and younger. That's just how it was. The beginning of the Cambrian was marked by the appearance of fossils, and if these Ediacaran structures were indeed fossils, then the rocks that he sat amongst must in fact be Cambrian. So sure was Reg of their biological nature that he was willing to rewrite the stratigraphic history of the area to allow them to exist. But not everyone was so convinced of Reg Sprigg's seemingly Cambrian jellyfish. Reg wrote a paper detailing his findings and submitted it to the prestigious journal Nature. Surely a discovery like this warranted the attention of all natural scientists worldwide, he thought. But the paper was rejected. And when he returned to the Premier of Australia with news of his remarkable discovery, the minister reportedly waved him away, saying, "Give me good copper-lead ore any day." Even when discussing them among his colleagues and fellow geologists, the structures were dismissed as fortuitous inorganic markings. In their kindest possible words, his contemporaries made it clear to Reg that they thought he was seeing things. Perhaps the Australian heat had finally gone to his head. Ultimately, although Reg endured the humiliation as long as he could bear, he gave up on his Cambrian jellyfish and instead went looking for oil with much greater success. And yet remarkably though, even this wasn't the first time that these strange late Precambrian markings had been found and subsequently ignored. Before the feather-like Charnia was uncovered by innocent schoolchildren in the 1950s, English examples of the same curious ring-like structures as in Australia had actually been identified as far back as the mid-1800s. But once again, they were dismissed as inorganic markings, formed in the rock itself, hardened and compressed, with no biological contribution necessary. In a book on the geology of the area published 100 years later, they didn't even warrant a mention. But all this changed with Charnia Masoni. Much more elaborate, much more compelling than the simple concentric ring, there was no doubt about the structure's origin. It was a fossil, for sure, and Trevor Ford even had the conviction to stick firmly to its Precambrian age. There was no more dismissing the Ediacaran structures as anything less than what they truly were. Remarkable evidence of a new kind of macroscopic, proterozoic life. Interest was renewed in the Australian specimens too, and more diverse forms were found, adding to the picture of this so-called Ediacaran biota. Interest in these enigmatic life forms only grew over the following decades. More and more fossil impressions were found dating to this final stage of the Proterozoic. In England, Australia, Namibia, the White Sea of Russia, Siberia, China, Brazil, Canada, and Ukraine. Soon, the Ediacaran biota was a global phenomenon, and paleontologists worldwide raced to find and identify new members of this most curious of fossil assemblages. Such was the cascade of new science coming from this paleontological gold rush that an entirely new geological division was proposed to demarcate those rocks lucky enough to have formed at the time in which the fossils are found. And so, in 2004, the Ediacaran period was finally ratified. It is the newest of geological subdivisions and the first to have been made for 120 years. Extending from its lower bound 635 million years ago, which is marked by the global cap carbonates that followed the last snowball glaciation, all the way up to the beginning of the Cambrian period and 538.8 million years ago, the Ediacaran period marks just less than 100 million years when, for the first time in Earth's history, giant organisms ruled the seas. In southern Newfoundland, the late summer brings violent storms that lash the coastline with howling winds and horizontal rain. Stunted juniper and cloudberry bushes grow sideways, pressed flat against the ground in the hopes of avoiding the worst of the damaging gusts. The clifftops are soaked by towering waves that exhaust their energies against the solid stone, and the sea spray obscures the ragged cliff edge with a cold, stinging mist. Even on the rare calm days, the coastline is obscured by this mist, whose tendrils reach up over the craggy rocks. Sailors battling the storms as they chart the northeastern coast of Canada see the cliffs looming out of the mist and spray and turn north, believing that they've passed Cape Race and have a clear path into the northern Atlantic. But they are deceived. There are two such bluffs, and turning too soon sees the luckless mariners driven hopelessly onto the rocks of southern Newfoundland. This so-called mistaken point has misled sailors time and time again, and now, in the bay to the east, nearly 100 wrecks lie. But not every day at Mistaken Point is beset by storms and fog, and not every ship falls foul of its treachery. On occasion, the sun shines a golden light onto the southern peninsula, illuminating the sloping rocks that jut out to sea. Without the crashing waves to obscure them, the crags are revealed as smooth, stepped surfaces, each a petrified memory of a seafloor long past. And on those ancient seafloors are shallow etchings and scrawls, only revealed in their true glory by the low-angled rays of a late afternoon sun. Crawling along the gently slanted plains with nose scarcely 6 inches above the rock surface, a paleontologist can imagine herself snorkeling through the Ediacaran Ocean during its prime. Such is the bounty of the fossils to be found on this remote, windswept shoreline. The remains of the Ediacaran organisms here in Newfoundland are typical for the period. They look as if they have been pressed into soft mud, which has since hardened to freeze their impressions through 600 million years of geological time. And this is indeed how they have formed. There are no shells or bones, no hard parts at all to be found within them. The life forms that left these death masks did so with only soft, fleshy bodies that have long since decayed away. That these imprints have lasted as long as they have is impressive in itself, but the detail they preserve is enough to take one's breath away. Laid before the incredulous paleontologist is a veritable garden of Ediacara. There are specimens of Charnia, very similar to the feather-like form found in England. These gently curving forms can be less than 1 centimetre long at their smallest, and reach more than 60 centimetres at their largest, looking like a finely quilted airbed that narrows towards its tip. In life, they stood alone, proud and erect from the muddy surface, pointing their tips up into the water, In death, they are felled, unceremoniously, into the mud. Other organisms seem to prefer a more lowly existence. Fractofusus, or the spindle creature, is found face down in the silt in death as it would have been in life. It is made of many repeating Charnia-like elements, broadly mirrored along a central axis, with each becoming thinner towards its two pointed tips. Scattered along the sea floor, they look like the detritus of an early autumn leaf fall. Bradgatia is constructed from many Fractofusus and Charnia-like elements, bundled together in three-dimensional shrubs like so many informal cabbages. Each prefers its own personal space as they're seen evenly distributed across the Ediacaran seafloor, protruding bulbously some 20 centimeters above the surface. Iveshedia is the only fossil among the ancient Garden of Mistaken Point that raises questions in its interpretation. Early researchers who documented the fossils referred to them as pizza discs, due to their resemblance to a lumpy circle of indistinct shapes, seemingly united by a formless smear of molten cheese. There was no symmetry or definite structure to unite them. Scholars suggested them to be the remains of balloon-like structures that were once tethered to the sea floor, but have since descended and deflated. Others suppose they were formless by design, much like modern-day sponges. But the discovery of some Fractofusus-like elements embedded like wayward pepperoni in these ancient pizza discs suggests that they were in fact colonies of the familiar forms that have decayed where they sat before being frozen in time. And so, the Garden of Ediacara in Newfoundland is rich and diverse, considering the paucity of macroscopic life to be found from the preceding billions of years. But there is yet more Ediacaran bounty to be recovered from other parts of the late Proterozoic Ocean, now found scattered around the globe. In Australia, where Reginald Sprigg first found his jellyfish-like forms, the soft-bodied fossils are also preserved as imprints in the ancient rock surfaces. But unlike Mistaken Point, where a paleontologist need only brave the occasional breaking wave as they walk across the former sea floor, out in the finder's range, the searching is much more back-breaking work. Instead of being squashed down into the mud of the floor, Australian Ediacarans are instead impressed on the underside of bedding planes, cast by the overlying sediment before the fleshy organisms have a chance to decay. And so, the hopeful paleontologist must search among these rocky ceilings, either by turning over heavy rock slabs, or by crawling wholesale under overhanging cliff edges. But the fossils found there are well worth the strenuous effort. Dickinsonia appears as a giant's thumbprint in the sand. Fine ridges radiate out from a central axis, curving gently to the shallow tip that marks its outer perimeter, which is roughly circular or oval in shape. The size variation of these imprints is staggering too. Specimens range from just a few millimeters to well over a meter across, but never grow more than a centimeter in thickness. Indistinct sequential impressions in the sand suggest the life form either hopped along the surface or was blown tip over tail like discarded newspaper in the wind. Kimberella is little more than a ridged, oval-shaped flange surrounding a misshapen lump, sometimes with a tube-like protrusion extending from one of its narrowed ends. And yet it's often found alongside scrape-like markings in the soft sediment surface. It could be coincidence, or it could be evidence of a slug-like organism searching blindly for food. And there are many more strange forms besides. In total, more than 200 different species have been described from Ediacaran rocks. Some, like Charnia, Fractophusus, and Braggatia, show clear relations to one another. But others are no more associated than mindless doodles in the sand. A staggering array of shapes, sizes, and lifestyles to be found in the Ediacaran oceans, united only by their lack of mineral support and, of course, their complete absence in our ecosystems today. And so, what are the alien organisms that ruled our late Proterozoic oceans? And how can they really be so different to all subsequent life on Earth? Martin Glesner is a dedicated man. His mind is never quiet, ever worrying, ever pondering the mysteries of the natural world. Even when the Austro-Hungarian is confined to a military hospital in Moscow in the 1930s, suffering from scarlet fever, he cannot bring himself to waste the hours laid up in bed. Instead, he ruminates on the contents of a new book, focused on the microscopic world of tiny fossils that help to guide oil prospectors in their search for black gold. Desperate not to lose the inspiration born of his enforced bed rest, he scribbles notes on borrowed hospital paper. And those notes need to be boiled to kill the fever-causing germs before they can be sent home to his wife for typing. Keeping his mind busy clearly helped his body recover, and soon enough he returned to oil prospecting work. During the later years of the Second World War, he moved halfway around the world to Australia, just before questions about his Jewish heritage could disturb his work. He finished his book and continued to search for life in the Australian wilderness before turning his attention in the late 1950s to rocks far too old to contain oil. In a way, he acted out the reverse of Reginald Spriggs' Ediacaran journey. Since the luckless Reg had turned to petroleum after no one seemed to care about his ancient sandstone fossils. But for Glesner, the intervening 10 years made all the difference. In that time, the English fossils of Charnia had been discovered, and the truth of the Ediacaran biota was beginning to emerge. This was a brand new area of paleontological study, and Martin Glesner was eager to give it his full attention. He studied every example of the Ediacarans he could get his hands on, documenting their peculiar morphology and singular mode of life. By now, their true pre-Cambrian age was clear, and Glesner pondered the relationships between these strange forms and the more familiar animal fossils that were to be found in rocks just a few millions of years younger. He came to a logical conclusion based on what he knew about the nature of evolution and the fossil record from younger times. These bizarre organisms, preserved as death masks in the sand, must be precursors to modern animals. the so-called missing link, that helps to fill the gaps between a predominantly microscopic Proterozoic and the dawn of animal life as we know it. It was a reasonable assumption, considering the unprecedented suddenness of the Cambrian explosion. And so, with this in mind, Glessner set about trying to find the ancestral forms of each of the main animal groups among the fossils of the Ediacaran. The famed Charnia quite closely resembles a kind of soft coral called a sea pen, named for their resemblance to feather quills used for writing. These corals belong to one of the most simple and primitive of animal groups, the Cnidarians, along with hard corals that build mineral skeletons, and a variety of free-swimming jellyfish. The Cnidarians are united by their stinging cells that help them to stun and catch their planktonic prey. And today, sea pens can be found rooted into soft sand worldwide, extending their feather-like veins upwards to sweep the water clear of food. The concentric rings that first piqued Reginald Sprigg's interest are now classified as fossils named Aspidella, which includes various rounded forms that range in size from 1 mm to almost 20 centimeters in diameter. Glessner thought they were the perfect candidate for the other abundant kind of Cnidarian, the jellyfish. Certainly, the larger forms could easily be mistaken for the jellies stranded on a beach. Another Ediacaran organism, named Sprigina, after Reg Sprigg himself, appears to be symmetrical around a central axis, with ridged body and a bulbous head at one end. Martin interpreted it as one of the first steps towards worms, which are some of the most dominant forms of the Cambrian explosion. And there were many more animal ancestors to be found. Martin Glessner and his colleague Mary Wade spent 25 years neatly pigeonholing the Ediacaran organisms into modern taxonomic categories. They even identified basal members of some of the higher animal groups, like echinoderms, which include the starfish and sand dollars, and which are the closest invertebrate relatives to the chordates, otherwise known as the vertebrates, which includes humans. The Ediacaran fossils Tribochidium and Archaerua have 5-part and 3-part symmetry respectively, something that's shared by many modern echinoderms, but extremely rare amongst any larger animals. With their diligent work, Glessner and Wade's animal interpretations became almost synonymous with the Ediacaran biota itself. When museums sought to refresh their displays with the compelling fossil impressions and their living missing link interpretations, the dioramas would inevitably feature sea pen-like Charnia waving from the surface, blind Sprigina worms inching along the mud, and primitive jellyfish swarming the sunlit waters. But there is a problem. Despite their valiant efforts to match one to another, these scholars' work is little more than simply that: pattern matching. And when these patterns are subject to scrutiny, the kind of scrutiny that's to be expected when searching for the ancestors to all animal life, then the veil of similarity begins to drop away, revealing fatal flaws in this simplistic interpretation. Take Charnia's resemblance to sea pens, for example. The modern forms, although they differ in size and colour, all have a common mode of living and mode of growth. The feather-like Cnidarians tend to retreat into their muddy burrows when danger looms, but there is no trace of burrows beneath any example of Charnia yet discovered. Not only that, but the sea pens grow from the bottom, as seen by the smaller segments that are to be found at the base of the feather-like vein. In contrast, Charnia's smallest elements are invariably found at the top. On closer inspection, the case for their similarity falls apart at the seams. The circular impressions left by Aspidella are indeed reminiscent of beached jellyfish, but they lack many of the other diagnostic features of jellies. There are no trailing tentacles, no prominent gonads. Nothing, in fact, beyond the slumped and wrinkled circular impression. They are no more similar to jellyfish than they are to an abandoned omelette. Plus, many examples of the same structure have been attached to the basis of Charnia-like fossils, which makes any free-floating interpretation challenging at best. And the compelling symmetry of Tribrachidium and Archaerua that places them optimistically among the echinoderms begins to wear thin, when that same symmetry is to be found elsewhere throughout the living kingdoms. From tiny single-celled organisms to the broccoli in your fridge and the roses in your garden, whenever self-similar elements need to be packed gradually, it's most efficient for them to do it with 3- and 5-fold symmetry. What's more, many other Ediacaran organisms, like Pteridinium and Swartpuntia, which Glesner variously ascribed to cnidarians and other animal groups, also possess the 3- and 5-fold symmetry. So this feature alone cannot be diagnostic of a higher invertebrate group. Even the bilateral symmetry along a central axis, seen in fossils like Dickinsonia and Spragina, which tempt us to draw parallels with the evolutionary branches that eventually led to us, is not quite as it seems. Instead of being truly mirrored along a central seam, the ridges and repeating quills of many Ediacarans are actually slightly offset. This gives the central line a zigzag appearance, and is a kind of symmetry known as a glide plane, which isn't seen in any modern animal group at all. On balance, the Ediacaran organisms may superficially possess certain characteristics in common with animal groups, but they unanimously fail to present any of the features that would be considered diagnostic for any animal. They have no evidence of a mouth, gut, or anus, no organs that could definitively be said to be used for filtration, and no means of, or indeed evidence for, intentional locomotion, either along the sand or through the water. So, although these museum dioramas and interpretations are certainly compelling, they fall far short of an accurate picture. Both the lifestyles and evolutionary relationships of the Ediacaran organisms are likely to be much stranger than we have yet imagined. After the false starts of their discovery and recognition, the age, complexity, and utter strangeness of the Ediacaran biota is no longer a subject of debate. Rather, it represents one of the greatest frontiers in paleontology in the 21st century. Scientists all around the world are devising ever newer ways to glean as much information as possible about these enigmatic organisms that thrived long before the Cambrian era, when animal life was traditionally thought to have its roots. Field geologists continue to scour the globe for more species, as well as additional examples of known species, to further our knowledge about their biodiversity and environmental distributions. The fossil-rich seafloor surfaces of Mistaken Point in Newfoundland are being laser-scanned to the highest possible resolution, in the hopes of revealing new detail not immediately obvious to the naked eye. The digital record will also preserve the paleontological treasure long after the craggy rocks have been lost to the sea. And 3-dimensional Ediacaran fossils from Namibia are subjected to CT scans, much like those used in medical imaging, to reveal their hidden structure and any internal details that may remain within their sandstone tombs. Scarcely ever has a single group of fossils been subject to so much intense examination. And yet even now, they clutch their secrets close to their quilted, ridged, and wrinkled chests. They still don't yield any of the animal features we'd expect for the missing link before the Cambrian explosion. But there's little consensus on an alternative either. A big question that still surrounds these organisms, and one which can help to narrow down their place on the evolutionary tree, is just how they get energy and nutrition in sufficient quantity to allow them to grow larger than any other life form before them. Trevor Ford, discoverer of the first example of Charnia in England, thought that it represented some kind of seaweed, and so was able to make its own food by photosynthesis. Certainly, its leaf-like shape is evocative, and there are modern and fossil examples of seaweeds which pump their tissues full of air in order to stay afloat and free of any sediment that might cover them and their photosynthetic pigments. But examination of the environment at Mistaken Point, where examples of Charnia are also found in abundance, reveals it to be closer to the deep sea than the sunlit shallows. In those deep, dark, muddy waters, there would be no light to fuel a photosynthetic seaweed, so anything living here must find its nutrition elsewhere. What could be the source of that nutrition? There are really only two places it can come from: the water or the sediment itself. Some animals today are able to filter tiny organic particles straight from the water column, including the bizarre-looking tube worms found around black smoker chimneys at deep-sea hydrothermal vents. But this strategy only really works when there is plenty of food to be found in the water. There is a reason the tube worms are found where they are, and that's because the underwater vents expel energy-rich particles from deeper within the Earth's crust, which fuels an entire ecosystem to support these large, complex animals. But in the typical Ediacaran Ocean, this nutritional bounty is sadly lacking. There's no sign of volcanic vents near any of the fossil sites, and without a much more churned up ocean bottom, the kind of disruption that comes from burrowing worms, for instance, which haven't yet evolved, then there's no mechanism for getting particles into the water. And so filtering water probably wasn't how these organisms fed. In fact, most Ediacarans didn't actually live the way that Charnia seems to have. Many, like the spindle-shaped Fractavusus and the tablecloth-sized Dickinsonia, spent their lives pressed down into the mud. So, presumably, there was good reason for doing so. And that reason may well have been for food. Remember, however, that none of the fossils have features we can definitively recognize as a mouth or a gut. And so if there's any nutrition to be had in the mud, then it was obtained by more subtle means: the absorption through the outer tissues and diffusion to the cells within. And while this is certainly possible, it's not a very animal-like thing to do. Instead, it's much more common among the fungi. Who extend their thread-like hyphae through modern soils in search of energy-rich bounty in the form of other decaying organisms. Today, fossil evidence suggests that the fungal kingdom, which is itself closely related to the animals, had already made its appearance before the Ediacaran period. So this interpretation for some or all of the fossils is not altogether unreasonable. And yet, among all the diverse forms that we know that fungi can take, there has never been anything like the Ediacaran anatomy. While it doesn't rule out a fungal affinity, it certainly doesn't give us much to go on. So the question remains unsolved for now. Scientists have tested almost every conceivable hypothesis and found nothing that sticks. Some have even suggested that these giant forms aren't truly multicellular at all, but maybe gigantic single-celled organisms, like the nummulite fossils that make up the limestone from which the Great Sphinx is carved. Or they could be loose and temporary colonies of smaller cells, which come together for reproduction or at times of hardship. But without more supporting evidence, like microscopic fossils or chemical signatures, it's impossible to know this for sure. And unfortunately, while the preservation of the shape of the Ediacaran fossils is spectacular, the sandstones that typically hold them are very poor preservers of any other clues. Of course, the possibility remains that the Ediacarans represent something entirely different to any other life form we've seen before or since. They could be a false start, a failed experiment at multicellularity before the much more successful animal organizations came about. If that is the case, then we would have absolutely no comparisons, no reference, and no anchor to any other part of the evolutionary tree. It is as if they are an entire limb that has fallen from the tree of life. A dead-end cul-de-sac, leaving no trace where it once grew. And some scientists are content to leave it there, to consider the Ediacaran biota in isolation, and not concern themselves with questions of affinity that seem to be unanswerable. And yet, considering the examples laid out by the rest of the 3 billion-year-old paleontological record, and everything we know or believe to be true about the workings of evolution, it seems entirely implausible that the Ediacaran period contains no ancestors of animals at all. Martin Glessner's original reasoning for pigeonholing the Ediacaran forms among living animal groups was sound, even if his pattern matching overreached itself. The Cambrian explosion is the most dramatic radiation of life ever seen on Earth. And it's almost inconceivable that the evolutionary precursors to that extraordinary moment remain hidden, especially when there are macroscopic organisms in the period just before. How then do we account for the unfamiliarity of the Ediacaran biota? Why does nothing look like an animal if that's what they'll ultimately become? To answer that, we need to remind ourselves that the course of evolution never did run smooth. It is not a ladder leading from one straightforward rung to another, and the tree of life is so named purely because it is so tree-like. There are many branches, most of which may have no future, but it only takes one rogue, breakaway lineage to succeed, and an entirely new path is formed. So any one of the diverse Ediacaran forms could have been the ancestor to the entire animal kingdom, with the others disappearing into obscurity. It's a tale that many of us are familiar with from a much more recent geological time. What were the dinosaurs, after all, but a failed experiment into giant lizardhood that ultimately gave rise to birds? Perhaps also we are unreasonable in our expectations that animal ancestors should look recognizable at all. Even the most primitive groups, the cnidarians and sponges, which are thought to have evolved first among all the animals, look the way they do today, thanks to more than 500 million years of evolution alongside the rest of the animal kingdom. Indeed, what is the use of the stinging cells that define the jellyfish and corals if there's nothing else around in the ocean to sting? It's more than likely that the first Cnidarians didn't have this diagnostic characteristic, because there was simply no need for it before any other animals had evolved. Similarly, the porous skeleton of modern sponges, constructed to help the formless organism filter food particles from the water column, is only really sustainable if there are other animals around to help maintain that structure. Without shrimp to clear detritus from a sponge's pores, they quickly become blocked and the sponge will die. So without this modern-day spar, early sponge creatures would be all but unrecognizable. So there's really no reason to think that the very first members of these, or indeed any animal group, should look anything like they do today. And if that is the case, then we have come full circle. From discounting the animal affinities for Ediacarans, to the conclusion that they must be the missing links we're looking for, even if we don't know exactly what we're looking at. Some or all of the Ediacarans may indeed be the first tentative steps into animalhood, as multicellular forms began to experiment with tissues, organs, and novel body organizations, but have yet to settle on a truly winning combination. This is scientists' best guess, for now. But the science of the Ediacaran biota is still little more than 50 years old. It is in its infancy compared to the long history of much of the rest of paleontology. There's still much to be done and much to be discovered. Who knows what insight the next 50 years will bring? You've been watching the entire history of the Earth. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think as we move ever closer to the Cambrian explosion. Arguably the single most important event in the entire history of life on Earth. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.